Live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Okay, it's Thursday, 1 o'clock, and you are tuned in to the Farm Report, bringing it in a little slow today.
That's because...
Why?
It's your 100th episode.
Woo! Oh, awesome. So happy, what is it, centennial? Centennial
Something
to the
like
Farm
that.
Report.
Yeah, congratulations, Erin, and congratulations... to an old friend, Heather, who is on the line and hosted 73 episodes of this wonderful program.
Hey, Heather.
Hey, you guys. Hi, Erin. Hey, everybody. Congratulations. You guys have me nervous and crying over here.
Don't cry. The show will go on.
It's going on. Good job holding it down. And congratulations. It's exciting.
Yeah, the Farm Report was actually what I guess the second show we've ever done on this network. There was the News Hour with Patrick Martins, and then there was the Farm Report with Heather. And that's, you know, just when we opened in 2009. So this is the longest running program on Heritage Radio Network. And thank you, Heather, for all of your contributions, and thank you, Erin,
thank you guys,
for holding it down.
Awesome.
Well, rock on. 100 episodes strong and another 100 to come.
I'm sure.
Rest of your show.
Thanks a lot, awesome. Heather. Thanks for calling in.
Of course. Take care, you guys.
Yeah, you too.
Bye.
Oh, that's it.
Yeah. Great. So here we go. 100th show. I am totally stoked to have live in studio one of my favorite people in the entire world, Monica Patel. Monica, in addition to being a dear old friend, is a policy specialist for the Ecology Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Monica, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Erin.
So I'm excited. You have such a kind of great work history, and I want to tuck into a little bit of everything, but I think we should probably start out by talking a little bit about what is the Ecology Center, what type of work they do, and then what is your role there as a policy specialist?
Yeah, totally. The Ecology Center, is awesome. We started, just like many other ecology centers all over the U.S., 41 years ago on the world's first Earth Day, which actually was where I was at U of M, University of Michigan, where Erin and I went to school. Since in the last 41 years, we've done all kinds of things, including providing environmental services like recycling and things like that to our community, and then also working on environmental issues more broadly. So we do a lot of policy work in Lansing, which is our state capital, and then we also work locally and nationally. So we're kind of all over the place, and we've grown to follow passions over the last 40 years, and we do all kinds of environmental health and environmental justice work.
And how long have you been working for the Ecology Center?
I've been there for 4 years, which bizarrely is like my longest job ever.
Congratulations, 4 years! So, you know, before the show, we're talking about some of the projects that you've worked on, and just to kind of go over them quickly, you've done work on coal and clean coal, a project called Beyond Coal, a program called healthystuff.org, where basically you looked at testing kind of everyday consumer goods from children's toys to cars to see, you know, was there any kind of dangerous
toxic chemicals? Yeah, we're looking for lead and mercury and arsenic in everyday products.
And that's scary, but we're going to talk about that in a minute. Also, right now, your current project is the Ann Arbor 350 project, which basically works with individuals and households on how they can mitigate the effects of climate change through kind of change in their everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to start the show with some work that you had done a little bit earlier in your career with regards to water and water rights. And I think I'd like to start out, you know, we talk a lot about on the show about farming, and one of kind of the major inputs to a farm is water, and access to water really determines kind of how people grow, what they can grow. And I want to talk a little bit about this idea of watershed, because I know for me, it was one of those words I always heard, but I didn't really ever understand what a watershed meant. So I was hoping maybe you could kind of break down some of the scope of what a watershed is and some of the issues kind of around on water and what we should be sort of thinking about.
Yeah, absolutely. To prepare, because I knew you wanted to talk about watersheds, I did a Google search and went over to the New York League of Conservation Voters Education Fund. They have an incredible amount of information about, you know, New York City's watershed. And I found out that it's like almost 2,000 miles large, which is insane.
Yeah, New York City is crazy. I mean, it's basically, we have like giant tunnels built underground from the Catskills that like tube water in, and it's a really old system too.
It's a really old system, and it's unique because it uses gravity a lot. So instead of like pumping and using electricity to move the water, it relies on gravity, which is like, it can rely on hills and create enough pressure to pump water like up six stories. It's insane.
Holy cow.
Yeah. And so so the lower Hudson, like about 2,000 miles of land in the lower Hudson, generates water to I don't know, what's quench.
Yeah, the thirst of the
of like
know,
9 million. Yeah, 9 million people, and that's, so half of New York State's water supply comes from there. And basically, what a watershed is a land mass that collects precipitation and then filters it through that landmass in back into lakes and streams and marshes, and eventually, if it's in that landmass for long enough, into groundwater aquifers, like storage units, basically, for water. And around here, and you know, in Michigan where we come from, it's pretty plentiful. Our aquifers don't drain it, as you know, like they get replenished with mm-hmm. with precipitation and things like that. And then there's like the Ogallala Aquifer, which goes across a lot of the United States and the Southwest, and that's just like draining and not replenishing. And so we're really lucky to have a replenishing groundwater aquifers. And the cool thing that I also learned about New York's is that the water that comes from the lower Hudson is unfiltered, and so it travels by gravity into the city where it's treated, but it's mostly unfiltered, which is crazy because that means that you really want to take care of the land that's filtering that water, so it's it doesn't get contaminated. Like, you don't want major pollutants going in that land, in that 200 or 2,000 miles of land.
So if I'm trying to kind of envision this, you know, the watershed is basically this geographical area.
Mm-hmm.
How do you draw a boundary? I mean, how do we know when one watershed starts and another stops? I mean, is it that specific, or?
I actually don't think it's that specific. I think, you know, I think it has to do with just the general patterns of water, but that changes over time based on geography and elevation and things like that. So it's not as a concrete a boundary as a state line or anything like that, but it's just the flow of water into tributaries and lakes. And so it's not as concrete as maybe you'd think.
And I think that's one of the things that makes managing water resources kind of so interesting, but also challenging, is it's a resource that goes across kind of these imposed boundaries of state or county or regional. So here in New York City, we're really dependent on our upstate neighbors to take care of our water. And so you had mentioned, you know, not wanting to keep that water source kind of clean mm-hmm. and pure. So what are some of the things that you would or wouldn't want to have like in your watershed, or what are ways where a watershed can get corrupted or polluted? Like, what are the things we should be looking out for?
I don't know as much about upstate New York as I'd like to, but I know that, you know, paper mills that used to bleach and bleach paper and create all of this like residue, and that they would pump back into water. That was a big issue in Michigan up north. And there's like quarries that strip away a lot of land and then end up using water to pump out the mineral or the resource that they're looking for. It ends up saturating the water supply with all the stuff that they're not looking for.
Okay.
And so that's, you don't want a lot of sediment, and you definitely don't want those things that we know are bad for human health going directly into the water supply.
And It's kind of crazy to me to think about essentially the ground as a giant filter, really. So, mm-hmm. you know, water precipitation comes down in the form of rain or snow or, you know, snow melt from different mountain ranges in the region and essentially disappears into the ground, which acts as like a filtering. So the ground is actually kind of cleaning the water as it goes down into the aquifer.
Yeah. So, I mean, one way to look at it, like soils are amazingly interesting because they, you know, they're like basically masses of minerals and sediment, right? And so soils kind of take those minerals and sediments out of the water so that it's part of the soil. And like the lower the water goes, the cleaner it gets.
Okay.
It's kind of amazing. I mean, like when I lived in Oregon and we would go hiking in the, near Mount Hood, it was like we were walking on our watershed, and it was literally like it was really well managed compared to eastern forests, and it was just really cool to really see that connection. And you know, it's funny because it's as much as everyone in New York City is dependent on people in the upstate to keep the water clean, New York City's runoff goes into water also. So your downstream users are dependent on you to keep your streets clean and to, you know, prevent sewer overflows. I mean, it's just so cyclical and fascinating how everything works together. And it's interesting to see how humans have come in and changed how nature has worked, and for good and bad.
Right. When I think about that with regards, you know, to farming, and I know that like that can be a big issue, I think in our region, but also in other parts of the country where you have, you know, really large farms or really large animal farms where you have kind of that same thing. You're using a lot of water. I mean, meat takes a lot of water.
Absolutely.
To produce.
Yeah.
And that goes into both what, you know, the animal is consuming, but also kind of the cleanup and everything kind of down the chain. So are there other, I mean, I know like, and maybe you're, maybe I'm putting you on the spot a little bit here, but as far as, there are like series of rules for farms with regards to like kind of how they need to treat water that flows on their property, like streams or ponds, as far as like what animals can and can't go in them or where they pump, like, for example, like a dairy farm where they like spread their manure. Do you know anything about like that impact on?
Yeah, I think the land use rules are different in different places, but I think generally farms need to have, I think they're called like storage ponds where runoff has to sit before it drains into the water, so it doesn't go like rushing into a groundwater supply. It has to actually like stay contained in a holding pond, basically. And yeah, large animal feedlot operations are one of the huge, like a huge source of water pollution, because you have basically poop, lots of poop getting into water. Nobody wants that.
I think we don't need any clarification there as to why that's bad. And I know like out in the western part of the country, I mean, there are some pretty contentious disputes around water. I know in California in particular, where you're looking at, you know, LA as like this huge urban center that has a real need for water resources. And then you have the Central Valley, which also is like a huge agriculture area. And so there's kind of, you know, if you talk a little bit about water rights, if we kind of transition there, I mean, how do we decide like whose water it is? You know, can I just put like a pump in the ground and like start selling bottled water? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, in a lot of places you can. It's a huge problem, actually, because, you know, there's this, a lot of people think that if you put a price on water, then that will help by creating a market for it. And a whole other group of people thinks that water is a human right. It shouldn't have a price on it. And so there's an issue because California ended up tapping a lot of neighboring states' water supplies to provide high population areas. In Michigan, we have similar issues in the north, where a couple of years ago, Nestle bought some property and was pumping all kinds of groundwater out of that area and depleting some aquifers, and local residents sued them. And it's, you know, I think that's going to happen a lot more, that kind of litigation, just because we have a limited water supply and a growing population, and there are definitely towns in arid areas that are running out, and where do they go except to the towns that have, like, you know, Great Lakes states, basically, in the U.S. that have this amazing resource, but it's hard to manage, and right now it seems to be we're basically giving it away. That's what a lot of the people in Michigan are really upset about, is like there are limits on how much you can pump, but they're kind of insane limits. You can pump like so much, so it's an issue.
Huh. Well, we're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, I'd like to move into some of the other projects you've been working on.
On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com. With you, so I call you on the tin can phone. We rendezvous a quarter to the next shower alone. Think I found a way for you and I to finally fly. When we get there, we're gonna fly so far, making sure to laugh while we experience anti-gravity.
Okay, a little sad to bring it back after that kick butt break song. You are listening to the Farm Report on the Heritage Radio Network, and I am live in studio with Monica Patel, a policy specialist for the Ecology Center. So, Monica, the first half of the show, we were talking a little bit through watersheds and water rights, and I want to move on to some of the other work you've done. Can you tell us a little bit about the Healthy Stuff Project and what that involved?
Yeah, I'd love to. I'm kind of a jack of all trades at the Ecology Center, so it's nice to talk about our different projects. HealthyStuff.org was founded about 6 years ago because we got this crazy X-ray device that we were able to rent from this company who makes them. And this X-ray device emits this sort of like a dental X-ray, and based on when it gets back, it can tell you what elements are in a project or in a product, like within in the surface of it. And so, going back to like elemental chemistry, it means like you can look for lead and mercury and arsenic and other chemicals. And so, we got this product, and we had already been working on cars because we are in near Detroit, and
yeah.
So that's what we do. And so we decided to go out and start testing cars and seeing what was in stuff. And it's this cheesy ass, sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear, but it's this crazy looking device with flames on it. And a lot of departments of community health use it to screen stuff. And so that's what we did. And we looked in cars and we found actually a lot of flame retardants that didn't need to be there that would break down in the foams and fabrics of cars and get into the dust. And we came upon this kind of incredible indoor air quality problem where the air we breathe indoors is contaminated by the products that aren't very well regulated in our consumer stream. And so we try to test as many products as we can because so many things aren't labeled. Nothing in the marketplace says like I'm a rubber ducky that has lead in it. You know, it's like
not the
rubber
a big
ducky,
selling point.
Yeah, the rubber ducky with lead or, you know, other chemicals are look just like the other rubber duckies. And, you know, these chemicals are added to provide like various properties. So like for a rubber ducky, you know, elasticity or for the color to stick for a while or things like that. But there are other chemicals that aren't as toxic that you can use to the human body. And so it's this amazing connection between our marketplace and green chemistry, which is this newly emerging sector in chemistry that's amazing.
So you know, you're freaking me out a little bit because I thought I only, you know, there's been in the news over the course of the last year, all these reports of kind of contaminated stuff from China, you know, mm-hmm. finding out that like these children's toys or whatever have, you know, unsafe levels of a variety of toxic chemicals. And I guess I just thought somebody was in charge of that. So are you saying that nobody's testing this stuff or?
No, people are testing it. We actually have a law on the books called the Toxic Substances Control Act, but it was made in 1970. And everybody kind of has this sense that since 1970, a lot more chemicals have been introduced than the law has been able to keep up with, basically. And so Europe has stronger laws, and Japan has some stronger laws, and so does Canada. And so our big policy push is to be stricter in the United States. And it's an import and an internal issue. So like we didn't find that only products from China had stuff in them, you know, products from all over the place, high-end products, low-end products.
Can you give an example of like some of the kind of stuff that we might find like in our house that we might not be even thinking about?
So we've been doing a study on foams. So any of your anything in your house that has foam in it, your mattress, your couches, your stuff like that. We've also tested accessories, so purses, like, you know, they're pleather or they're leather, and pleather usually has vinyl in it, and that breaks down, and that's also not great when it's manufactured for workers. And so we've also tested pet stuff. That was really interesting because we found that sometimes tennis balls for pets had more crap in it than tennis balls for humans, but pets put the tennis balls in their mouths. And it was just, so there's no rhyme or reason to what we find, which is why we really think it needs to be regulated way upstream.
Right.
And we're not trying to freak people out because humans have some, you know, elasticity themselves in terms of we can handle small amounts of things.
Right.
The concern is that we're going forward so fast without stopping to think, like, what are we actually putting into our indoor, like, air quality?
Mm-hmm.
And so we really want to, like, put the brakes on this market movement and just make the market stop and think about what these products could be doing to our health. And because, like, one thing that's also been happening in the past couple of years is a lot of reproductive issues, you know, and cancer is like growing, and why are these things happening?
Right.
And one thing we might think is an avenue is our indoor air quality and our products.
Yeah. So. And I think there's like definitely like ties to agriculture too. I know I was just doing a little reading on azatrine. It's like a huge herbicide used in corn production that's recently been linked to fertility issues in frogs, where essentially male frogs will turn into females who are fertile after exposure to this chemical. And so, I mean, I think there's just like a lot of things happening around this that are very interesting. And for me in particular, it's like just another example of the importance of the role of government and like what is their role in kind of protecting the consumer and how as consumers we should be asking for this protection. So I want to move into the coal project, because that is not an issue we've talked about much on the show, but it is something that, you know, people are super familiar with kind of coal, and it has really this bad rap, but like really what are the alternatives as an energy source? And this whole idea of clean coal, I mean, is that a real thing or?
No, clean coal is a dirty lie. no, so clean coal is kind of way... like it seems millions of dollars or maybe billions. I get lost after millions.
Lots of zeros away
from being a commercial thing and being able to really help us out in terms of our timeline for clean coal and our timeline for climate change just don't line up very well. And coal has been around for a really long time. The issue is kind of like we have so many existing coal plants. Mm-hmm. And so why I was working on coal in Michigan was because they were trying to introduce new coal plants. And when you build a new coal plant, that means you're going to have that thing around for 50 or 60 more years. And so that's kind of not the direction we want to go in. And coal and petroleum and lots of fossil fuels have been basically subsidized for a really long time. Like, we're not actually paying what they cost. And so that's been kind of an issue in terms of getting renewables online, because we renewables, we're expecting people to pay what they cost.
Okay.
And so it's kind of unfair to the renewables industry, because they're like coal and fossil fuels have this huge advantage, right? Because they're not. They're really cheap.
Because we're not paying the real cost. So when you're talking about renewables, what are some specific things you're thinking about as far as?
So the two obvious ones are wind and solar.
Okay.
So wind turbines and solar panels. And then there's also geothermal, which is using kind of the temperature of the earth to regulate the temperature of what's on the surface of the earth. So, and then there are other technologies like algae and biomass and all these things that people are looking into and researching to develop, but they can't quite do it fast enough to displace fossil fuels.
So,
and we don't have government regulations that are allowing people to do it.
That are supporting that. So, I mean, if I think about, you know, we're thinking about kind of these big issues in energy and kind of energy sources are a big one. And it can feel like a little insurmountable. You know, coal obviously has this huge history, both in the U.S. and the world, and has really fueled the Industrial Revolution and allowed for a lot of really rapid progress.
Mm-hmm.
And has been kind of undergirded because it was so important to our nation's economy. And so now for us to kind of stop and say, hey, we're going to, you know, can we just like turn off the coal spigot? I mean, is that what does that transition look like in an ideal world?
Yeah, I mean, that's what's hard to say. I think no one really thinks we're just going to like stop all of the coal plants. But there are I think we need to employ a variety of different kinds of tactics. Right now, we've had a lot of coal and we just burn it, you know, and we haven't really looked into energy efficiency. How can we actually use less over time by making our buildings more like sounder, you know? Like right now, I mean, if anyone lived in rental housing ever, you know that the windows are crappy or like hot air, you're just like blowing coal out your windows.
Well, I know in my bedroom, yeah, the heater's on and the window is open because I have like no control. And maybe that's, we'll wrap up a little bit with some of the kind of personal end user things. You know, you are working on this new Ann Arbor 350 project that is basically creating resources for households or individuals to kind of look at how they can impact of climate change. So what are some of the strategies that you're introducing people to, and what are you like, what's the response out there? What are you finding is like being really well received?
We're actually working on food a lot and gardening, because part of adapting to climate change is kind of being able to provide resources more locally, so they don't have to travel all over the place, and so people everywhere know how to get their basic needs met. And gardening has been a really fun one, and we're trying to get people to do it's a good one for me, reminding people where food actually comes from and what it looks like and how it can be this amazing resource for children. And so that's our big one. And then we also work on household energy efficiency and things that make people fall asleep like that. But we're trying to make them fun and exciting. So that's what we do.
Well, so household energy efficiency. So not a lot of homeowners in I don't know, my circle of friends, I mean, present company excluded, but do you have any tips for people who are kind of renting or like young urban professionals who want to kind of do what they can from a home standpoint to have a greener house? I mean, in addition to just like, you know, recycling and turning the lights off, are there other things that we should be asking our landlords for or thinking about?
Yeah, like weatherizing your windows in the wintertime is a big one. Like, you know, that little layer of plastic helps. If you can get so far as insulating your walls, that's great, but it's harder to do. Replacing old appliances with new ones, that's a big one, because they're so much more efficient now than they have been in the last 20 years.
And you don't run into any, I mean, with the replacement issue as far, I mean, this is kind of always something I struggle with, where it's like, do I use something to the very end? Or, you know, is there, I mean, obviously there's something of a trade-off there, but kind of the thinking is that moving to more energy efficient is the way to go.
Yeah, and there's recyclers who are breaking those things down responsibly, and so they don't have to just go into a landfill, you know? It can be done right manufacturing stream-wise.
Awesome. So if we want to learn more about, you know, the Ecology Center in Michigan and the type of work that you're doing, I mean, is there somewhere we can go to follow up on the conversations we started today?
Yeah, www.ecocenter.org.
Awesome. Well, Monica, thank you so much for coming on the show and coming to New York to visit. I am excited. Next week, we'll have D.B. Emmons and Eva Samalipa of Wild Flavors on the show. Partnership between a chef and a gardener looking at 46 plants over four seasons and the connection between the garden and the plate. So looking forward to that. Hey, tune in next week.
Congratulations on Go-tober also.
Oh yeah, and Go-tober wrapping up. If you have not visited one of the NYC locations, this is your last week to do so. So get your butt out there. We were at, big shout out to the folks over at Minetta Tavern last night who really hooked it up with a delicious goat duo. Definitely check that out. Goat is seasonal and it is wrapping up, folks. So if you haven't, visit www.heritagefoodsusa.com to get a list of restaurants where you can get your go on this week.
Happy 100th show. Woo!
No, no, no!